This is a special call to action to our listeners to financially support this podcast and spread awareness of the Native Plants Dialogue through exclusive Plant Native Nebraska merch at plant-native-nebraska.myspreadshop.com. Wear our designs in your best effort to convert your friends and neighbors, or just simply look cool. Thank you for your continued support in our quest to help Nebraska plant native. I want to introduce everyone to Midwest Natives Nursery. They have done such a wonderful job at providing affordable Nebraskan and regionally native plants and delivering them to our doorstep. We couldn't be happier with the quality of Nathan's plants for a nominal price per pot. And I just love finding those native plants on my wish list that I can't source anywhere else. Located in Lincoln, Nebraska, Midwest Natives specializes in the sustainable cultivation of perennial wildflowers and grasses native to the Great Plains. They strive to provide the highest quality, healthiest, and pesticide-free plants to homeowners wanting to protect and promote pollinators and wildlife in their own backyards. Their selection of locally grown and non-cultivar natives is the largest in Nebraska, making them your one-stop shop for plants that will thrive in any landscape situation. From ground covers to prairie giants, from standing water to bone dry soil, from full sun to full shade, and with blooms spanning spring to fall in every color and shape you can imagine, you can be sure that Midwest Natives has the best plants for you, your landscape, and the environment around you. Kick off your 2024 growing season with a bang by joining Midwest Natives at their spring opening day sale in Lincoln on Saturday, May 4th. For more information, recommended plant lists, and other helpful guides, visit their website today at www.midwestnativesnursery.com. Hello, and welcome to the Plant Native Nebraska podcast. I'm your host, Stephanie Barlman. If you are new to tuning in, this show is for native plant enthusiasts, aspiring gardeners, suburban homeowners, growers, and thinkers anxious to learn more about growing Native American plants and creating habitat for wildlife. If this sounds like you, you've come to the right place. In today's episode, the very real importance of pollinators. We chat with Jennifer Hopwood and Ray Powers from the Xerxes Society about the importance of pollinators and what foods make it to our plate, why European honeybees can't do all of the work, and some ways you can help pollinators at home. I also want to give a special thanks to our friends at Lauritzen Gardens and Midwest Natives Nursery for sponsoring today's episode. As always, thanks for listening. Thanks so much to Jennifer Hopwood and Ray Powers for today's chat. Jennifer Hopwood is the Senior Pollinator Conservation Specialist at the Xerxes Society for Invertebrate Conservation. She has a master's in entomology from the University of Kansas and is based in Omaha, Nebraska. Jenny provides resources and training for pollinator and beneficial insect habitat management and restoration in a variety of landscapes. Jennifer is the co-author of several books, including Farming with Native Beneficial Insects, Farming with Soil Life, 100 Plants to Feed the Bees, and a Roadside Revegetation Manual. Ray Powers is also a pollinator conservation specialist with Xerxes. In collaboration with the Natural Resources Conservation Services, she works with farmers, ranchers, and others to identify wildlife conservation opportunities and promote pollinator and beneficial insect habitat across landscapes. Ray has a master's in plant ecology from the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, and has worked in grassland restoration and management and native plant production. And without further ado, today's chat. Well, I will start off by saying I am so excited for you both to be here. So thank you, Jenny and Ray. I am so glad to highlight some of the work and expertise that the Xerxes Society has. I just want to preface today's chat by saying I gleaned the talking points from this wonderful book, Attracting Native Pollinators. That was actually a book by four Xerxes staff members. I found it at the local library. I gave it a good read. I thought it was great. And to those listening, you can look for a copy of this at xerxes.org. It's on their website. You can do what I did, go to your local library, or you can find it at your local bookseller of your choice. So let's get to it. The basics of pollination. It's always been my understanding that pollination equals viable seed from my very uneducated brain. So what happens exactly when a plant that depends on, for example, animal-assisted pollination, what's going on there? What's the process?
Yeah. Hi, Stephanie. So basically, we're just helping move the reproductive structures of plants from one part to another and one plant to another when insect-assisted or animal-assisted pollination is happening. So what happens is a bee or other pollinator or other animal is visiting a flower, and the male reproductive structure is getting attached to that animal or insect in some way. And then they're moving on to another flower, ideally of the same species. And that male structure is then transferred to the female structure, and that female structure is fertilized and does produce a viable seed. And we get kind of that mixing of genetics within plants. And this can happen in a pretty wide variety of ways. And some of them are really, really interesting and really specific to the plant and the pollinator. And some of them are quite hilarious. So I watched a really great video this morning of alfalfa getting pollinated by like leaf cutter bees, which are used for alfalfa plant pollination. And the alfalfa flower has a unique structure. When a weight is placed on one petal of the flower, it actually releases a structure that whacks the leaf cutter bee right in the face with the pollen. It kind of gets hit, and then the pollen is dusted all over its body. And then it moves on to another plant of the alfalfa and pollinates that. And it's an important pollination service for alfalfa seed producers. So that's just one story, and there's lots of cool pollinator and pollination stories.
I like the tale of purposeful violence.
Yes.
You get whacked in the face, but boy, is it an important job. So
definitely
keep at it, leaf cutter bee.
The role that insects play in pollination is really critical for like 80-85% of the plants worldwide. And here in North America, like about 75% of our flowering plants rely on animal pollinators. And that could be, as Ray hinted, it's mostly insects that provide that role. So those are groups like bees, butterflies, some moths, some beetles, flies, and wasps. And those groups are the six main groups of insects, but there are certainly other insects that visit flowers too. They visit flowers to get nectar, which is sugary, sweet, and gives them lots of energy. And then some of them also collect pollen, which is full of protein and nutrition and helps them reproduce, or they provide it for their young. So they're not really even necessarily trying to spread the pollen on purpose, but it just happens because the plants are drawing them in with those really wonderful resources.
It's cool that you brought up alfalfa, because I was reading that in the book that insects are very important when it comes to pollinating alfalfa, which is a food crop that's used for straw production primarily, I'm thinking.
Yeah, hay for forage for livestock.
Okay. So, I mean, since we're getting into it, what exactly is the importance of native bees or other insects like wasps, flies, and beetles to agriculture?
Right. Well, their role in agriculture is so important because a good chunk of our fruits and vegetables rely on animal pollination. And so pollinators play a really key role in our food systems. And, you know, you can think of some of the foods you had for breakfast. If you had melon or strawberries or blueberries, those, of course, came to us courtesy of a pollinator. But other links to our food systems, Ray also mentioned this too. You can link dairy cattle production to pollinators too, because alfalfa is a bee pollinated crop, clovers are bee pollinated crops, and those are things that dairy cattle are fed regularly. And other unique links in our food system include oils like sunflower oils, canola oils, and spices. And then, of course, things that we fry in canola and sunflower oil. So you can even link potato chips back to pollinators because
Wow,
they
yeah.
wouldn't be so tasty without the oils that we cook them in.
My son will appreciate that factoid.
Oh,
I'm gonna be
yeah.
like, did you know that you wouldn't get your precious potato chips without pollinators? Mind blown. Yeah. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, just so many links in our food systems to pollinators. And you know that adds up economically, so it's a significant amount of dollars. Something like, and estimates vary quite a lot from year to year, but you know, probably $18 billion in the US alone, worth of animal pollinated crops. And
Wow.
they contribute, you know, again, estimates vary, but roughly about 35% of agricultural production worldwide. So probably most important, though, you know, all these foods that we're talking about, they're really important to our diet, and they provide us with vitamins and minerals that we couldn't get through wind pollinated crops like corn and wheat. You know, there's just a limit that those crops can provide. We need things like vitamin C and folic acid and other things that we can get from animal pollinated crops. So they're really important to our health. But then you can set aside the role of pollination, and some of these same animals are playing other roles in the ecosystem that's really valuable to agriculture too. Beetles, flies, and wasps. Some of those groups are visiting flowers for nectar or to eat a little bit of pollen, but in other parts of their life cycle, maybe they're predators or they're decomposers. And the role of predators is really important in agriculture because some beetles, like a soldier beetle or a solitary mason wasp, they are hunters, and they will keep other animals in check, like herbivores of plants like aphids or caterpillars or mealybugs or other herbivores that can sometimes grow really large populations. These predators help keep them in check, and that is a really critical service, which is also worth billions of dollars to agriculture. And then decomposition is a little bit harder to quantify, but things like flies and beetles, they're breaking down dead plant material or animal waste or dead animal material, and that's returning really crucial nutrients to the soil. So they're improving soil health, they're reducing habitat for pest flies or pest insects. They're playing really critical roles too. So basically, these animals that are involved in pollination are involved in so many other ways that are really important to not just agriculture, but our ecosystems too.
Yeah, I think we've been exploring for quite a while just the actual value of, pollinators to ecosystems in general. So it makes sense when we're talking about agriculture, that ecosystem benefit of like the creating this harmonious balance between different species and plants and those kinds of interactions. Like it's the same kind of benefit because when you think of it, agriculture is just another, it's just another natural space. So that makes a lot of sense. Now I like how you brought up, and I like how this is pointed out in the book also, these insect pollinated fruits and vegetables expand our diet. So, without insect pollinated crops, we're talking about meat and we're talking about grain. And that would not be a very balanced, healthy diet. So they are kind of critical to making sure that we're eating from the food pyramid and from all these main food groups. It's interesting to think about.
One link I did forget to mention is that pollinators do actually contribute to meat production too in some parts of the United States, especially where we are in Nebraska. You know, we're in the Great Plains, and we have a lot of cattle producers that grow cattle on ranches. And on native rangeland, which is native prairie, and a really important component of native prairie are flowering plants, especially flowering wildflowers. And wildflowers provide nutrients for cattle. And I'll let Ray jump in. She's been a really critical part of some work that we've been doing.
We've been actually doing some analysis, sending some plant materials from native wildflowers throughout the Great Plains, to understand their forage quality for livestock and what minerals they're providing for livestock, because we know they're eating them. They're a fairly large component of the above ground biomass that we see out on native rangelands, and we just really want to be able to advocate for those species to ranchers and land managers, and they do provide really important nutrients. The crude protein levels and sort of their total digestible net energy is really important for cattle and livestock. But we're also finding that for many of the really critical macro and micronutrients and minerals that cattle, especially, but also other livestock classes need, they're pretty consistently higher in many nutrients than our native range, just the grasses are. So that sort of native grass profile would really be missing some of those crucial minerals that livestock need, and they're able to sort of provide for themselves by having a varied and diverse plant diet, out on native
Wow.
rangeland.
Can we get a little nerdy and talk about some specific wildflowers that you're studying?
Yeah,
That's
absolutely.
exciting. You're never gonna say no to talking about wildflowers.
Yeah, we never have a problem with
All right,
that.
so what's some good ones that you're seeing some good data from?
Yeah, we've collected from about 75 plant species across the Great Plains and a little bit in California. And some things are things that have kind of historically been listed as palatable or good forage. So definitely our legumes, our native legumes, like lead plant, looks pretty great when you look at its nutrient profile and what it's providing for minerals. Some surprises, although with recent research showing that cattle can preferentially choose milkweeds, it's maybe less surprising, but milkweeds are really performing very well. So these are our kind of big leafed showy milkweed and common milkweed, which I think milkweeds often are thought of by ranchers as something that's toxic and they don't want their livestock to have. However, there are many, many species of milkweed in the United States, and especially in the northern and central Great Plains, our species profiles are not very toxic. They have pretty low toxicity when it comes to those secondary compounds that might be bad for livestock. And in fact, we're finding, they're pretty high up on that forage quality and providing some really great minerals also.
Wow, to me that is mind-blowing because I've always thought of milkweed as being toxic to livestock. That's like stuck in my brain from reading something years ago. So that is actually revolutionary. Very, very cool.
So definitely some milkweed species are toxic to livestock, but those are primarily in the west, like west of the mount or Rocky Mountains and west. And there's also some pretty toxic species in the southern plains, but many of our milkweed species do not have toxic levels for livestock.
Wow, very cool. Yeah, I've always thought of forage plants too as mostly like grasses. So this is expanding my idea of like, cattle out grazing, they're eating wildflowers too and getting nutrients off that.
Yeah, certainly the percent of diet and sort of the selection of wildflowers varies with a lot of different, there's a lot of different variables that go into it, but that percentage of diet can be anywhere from 10 to 30% of livestock diet, and that changes by livestock class and time of year. And that includes also shrubs, which are, yeah, typically our flowering shrubs also. So kind of wildflowers and our native shrubs are really important.
Oh, wow, I didn't know that. Like, what kind of flowering shrubs are we talking about?
A lot of times that'll be things like snowberry, or if you've got plum stands, things that you typically see out in maybe riparian areas of grasslands.
Oh,
And that
wow.
would include things that are a little bit murky and classified as like a subshrub and an herbaceous plant, like lead plant, might also be one that's included, or winter fat as you move west.
We're still really working on ways to help producers learn about these plants and recognize them so that they can understand the role that they play in cattle production, as well as the roles that they play in the ecosystem, so that they can retain them whenever possible on rangelands. And so we're really excited to be working in this area in particular because rangeland producers are such an important conservation partner because their production really allows prairie to stay in place. And prairie, rangelands are such an important habitat for a wide range of wildlife, including pollinators. They're really unique species you can find on rangeland that you can't find elsewhere. So yeah, we're just really excited about this new information and excited to share it and get it out and spread it.
Yeah, it's to me, it's really eye-opening how it seems like there can somehow be a coexistence between agriculture moving forward into the future and conservation. And so this research is really exciting because I think if the case can be made and the data is there saying, we can do ag a little bit differently and conserve all these natural spaces at the same time. That's awesome. Very exciting. While we're on the vein of agriculture, we hear about honeybees a lot, and we hear about, you might read an article in the National Geographic talking about how farmers will take these pallets of honeybees basically and go and fertilize their farmland. And then these bees are shipped off to the next farm. I'm playing a little bit of devil's advocate here, but can't we just outsource pollination services by using these honeybees? Do native pollinators really make a difference when we have that kind of service?
Yeah, this is a really interesting question, and I'm going to talk about it from two perspectives. Just let's start with the agricultural perspective. Managed honeybees, which were introduced to the United States well before it was the United States, 400 or so years ago, by European settlers, are a species that really lend itself well to human management. In fact, they've been bred for centuries by people because they've been, really valuable for honey production. And it's just really been more recently in the human and honeybee relationship that we've been starting to manage them for crop pollination. But it's become more and more important as our agricultural systems have intensified, because, for example, let's say 75 years ago, 50 years ago, an orchard in northeast Nebraska might have fence rows with diverse habitat or shelter belts with diverse habitat, and that could support wild bees that would pollinate the orchard. So, they'd have those orchard producers would have plenty of production every year. But as we sort of expanded and intensified the agricultural crop itself, producers have taken out fence rows, taken out shelter belts, taken out wild spaces on farms to increase production and intensify it. And that does mean then that you don't have habitat for wild pollinators to play that role in crop pollination. So that's where honeybees have stepped in, and commercial beekeepers will bring their hives to certain crops, and they're sort of ephemeral and phenological based on which crops are blooming when. So there are some beekeepers, that are based here in Nebraska that ship their bees out west to California for early almond pollination, or to parts of Washington for apple pollination, and then they start to move back east again. Or likewise, they ship their bees east and then they start to move back west. But they have to artificially stock the density of pollinators in this orchard. And so they're really, sort of forcing the honeybees to forage on the crop at hand, whether it's apples or blueberries or whatever else. And honeybees have no choice, so they need to go out and gather the resources to keep their hives going. And so they're really important crop pollinators, without a doubt, because they keep these systems functioning. But there are still wild pollinators that do play an important role in crop pollination. For example, there are a number of wild bees that are important in different crops to different degrees. If you have habitat nearby on the farm or in the landscape. You can have a diverse community of wild bees active throughout the bloom period of apples. So when maybe one species completes its life cycle and kind of drops off, there are others that step in and contribute to pollinate. And just staying with the apple example, when apples bloom, it's sometimes right around now here in April, and it's always volatile in April. You don't know if it's going to be rainy or cloudy or windy or cool. And these wild pollinators they've adapted to these conditions over millions of years. And so they're used to flying in cooler weather. They're used to flying in windier weather. There's a really nice study in California that looked at pollination at different parts of an almond tree and found that when you have wild pollinators present in that almond orchard, that you have a higher seed set and higher production rates because those wild pollinators pollinate in different parts of the tree. Honeybees really are, they come from a Mediterranean climate, so they prefer not super windy conditions, not cool conditions, not rainy conditions. And in the springtime, especially, they're just more likely to sort of wait those conditions out, recognizing that in a day or two, they can probably get back out when it warms back up. But in the meantime, wild pollinators are transferring pollen really efficiently and effectively. So the short version is that you really, a diverse community of pollinators provides higher quality pollination, whether it's high yields in some cases or higher quality fruit, or sometimes larger fruits. So even when you have honeybees present, native bees improve production.
Right. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and so honeybees are amazing, but one species is not a substitute for a community of species. And that's true also for wild plant pollination. There are plenty of wild plants that honeybees aren't capable of effectively pollinating, that even really efficient and amazing pollinators like bumblebees aren't able to pollinate. You know, the plant pollinator relationship can be really unique and specific sometimes. So some plants need certain pollinators, and we can't just, you know, bring in honeybees to a prairie and expect that prairie to function as if it had a really diverse native pollinator community.
It's great to think that there's not really a one size fits all category for pollinators.
Yeah.
Like each is important in its own way. And also, I like the idea of maybe like giving people a metaphor. So, like, basically, your native pollinating insect is going to be the employee that's there when your European honeybee calls in sick. Like, they're going to be there to do the work. When the other guy's like, no, I'm gonna stay bunkered down at home. The weather is really iffy. I don't feel like driving in today. Just no. But our native pollinators are gonna be there doing the work because it's business as usual for them. So,
Yeah, not to suggest that honeybees aren't hard workers, because they really are amazing. Those foragers can fly like 6 miles. It's nuts. But wild bees do have really specific relationships with plants, and that can mean that they can be way more efficient. And for example, if you grow pumpkins or squash or zucchini in your yard, you might take a look this summer. You might have squash bees. You know, they're these quite large, robust, orangey, fluffy bees, and the females get up right as the sun is coming up. So as soon as that squash flower opens up, they're there gathering pollen. And in fact, their young can only survive on the pollen of cucurbita. So they're so closely tied to that plant that they'll build their nest in the ground underneath, and they don't collect pollen on other species. So they're so efficient in visiting the flowers that, you know, by the time honeybees are up and flying at like 9, 3 hours after the sun has come up, and the squash flowers are often fully pollinated by squash bees. So another example, if you've got plants like tomatoes or eggplants or other plants that have the pollen packaged up inside the anther rather than on the outside, those plants usually need to be sonicated in order to release that pollen. And sometimes that can happen with wind if you have like a lot of wind, but it's most efficient if you have wild bees. Like bumblebees in particular are very efficient at sonication, and they'll just go up to the plant, they'll grab either the petals or the anthers themselves and just sonicate by vibrating their wing muscles. And it can make this very specific frequency and sound that you can hear, just a like a zzz, and it shakes out all the pollen onto their bodies. And then they move on to the next flower and transfer that pollen again. And that's a behavior that honeybees don't have, for example. So native bees just have different behaviors in how they interact with flowers. And that really does make a difference. So
Wow.
yeah, it's
Really
pretty
cool
neat.
to think of the benefit that native pollinators have, not only in regards to our native gardens or our native wildflowers that we have growing, but also to our vegetable gardens. That's really cool to think about, that even though these are exotic plants that have been brought in for, food crop purposes, that native pollinators still have some healthy interactions there. So that's cool. That's really neat. For me, Lauritzen Gardens has been a great place to escape to nature. It's basically a native plant scavenger hunt each time I go. I have learned so much by observing plants up close, and since I pay for an annual membership, I can go whenever the mood strikes me. One of my favorite things to do is take my laptop in the fall and work in one of the little rest areas overlooking the meadow. Getting out into nature is so good for my personal health. I feel lucky Omaha has such a great botanical garden, especially one committed to conservation, and that has a coffee shop. Lauritzen Gardens is full of plant people, a team of dedicated horticulturalists, enthusiastic educators, and devoted conservationists committed to showcasing a diverse plant collection and fostering native biodiversity across 100 acres of land. It's a haven for plant enthusiasts like me, bird and butterfly watchers, photographers, and artists, with more than 20 themed garden areas that invite you to experience and be inspired by the unique beauty of each season. With a year-round schedule of horticulture displays, garden-based programming, special events, exhibits, and group tours, there are countless opportunities to find meaningful experiences in nature, to grow your mind, or just to enjoy a peaceful moment in a beautiful and natural setting. If you love plants, find your place and your people at Omaha's Public Garden and one of my favorite places. Visit in person at 100 Bancroft Street in Omaha, or find them online at lauritzengardens.org. I did want to circle back to just talking about pollinator benefit for ecosystems in general and not focusing so much on agriculture. The importance of pollinators to just natural habitat, natural healthy ecosystem support. What would you like to talk about there?
Do you want to talk about how pollinators support rare plants, right?
Sure. Yeah, we can do that. I think pollinators are really critical for diversity in our natural places for a number of reasons. And definitely one of those is helping and maintain and increase that plant diversity by having those insect pollinated plants in those plant communities, which just makes them more robust and resilient for sure. And we know that there are many endangered or threatened plants that rely on native pollinators to produce seed and to remain reproductive. And there's some really interesting pollination stories with our endangered species, plant species here in Nebraska. Recently went to a talk with someone from our heritage, natural heritage program staff, talking about a couple of different orchid species that are threatened in our state. So the Western Cray-Fringed Orchid is a pretty cool endangered plant species. It's really showy and beautiful orchid that can be found in the eastern part of Nebraska and some kind of limited populations. And it's got the tube of the flower that holds the nectar. It's actually the longest tube in North America, in temperate North America. And so you can think about a pollinator accessing. They have to be able to get their proboscis way down in that tube. So you can probably already imagine there's not going to be bees. Bees or flies, even long-tongued bees, nowhere near long enough to access that nectar resource. So they're dependent on a pretty small group of pollinators, on hawk moths, on a few species of hawk moths that are present in the state. And it's there's some interesting papers. So their proboscis needs to be long enough to reach the nectar, but not so long that when it actually they hit their eyeballs, the pollinia hit their eyeballs and stick to the eyeballs of the moth. So if they have too long of a proboscis, then that pollen doesn't attach to the eyeballs or the pollinia. And it also talked about the actual structure of the pollen being the right distance, but like between the eyes, so that it actually does land on the eyes. So you sort of have all these pieces lining up. And in addition to that, to prevent self-pollination by that plant species, there's actually a 60 seconds during which those pollinia, they're not receptive yet to go to the stigma, so that they actually change position, so then they can be delivered to a stigma, and it takes about 60 seconds for that to change after they've been deposited on the eyeballs. So that Western Prairie Fringed Orchid and the hawk moth relationship is really just one example of a rare plant.
Wow.
Depends on a really specific pollinator. And it's also a species that we think that the pollination is probably a limiting factor. Certainly habitat loss and disturbance are playing into that, but they do seem to be maybe pollinator limited as well.
Wow. I think that's a really crazy story. You watch Planet Earth and you see some stuff like this, and you're like, what? You
It's
don't
happening
really
in your
appreciate,
backyard too.
yeah, the
Yeah.
complexity of life is actually really just kind of insane. Now I know when we talk about the importance of pollinators to habitat, we could talk about is that pollinators are really important for birds as a food source. I've been reading on that. Birds are rearing their young primarily on insects. Like they're not feeding seeds or berries to their babies. They're feeding these big forms of crude protein in the form of larvae or caterpillars. Can we know maybe some specific examples of pollinators as a food source for birds or their importance to bird populations?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's pretty across a pretty broad group of birds also, or a lot of our bird species. When they're young, they do need those insect food resources. And in the East, there's been, a fair amount of research on songbirds or eastern birds, and how much they rely on our Lepidopteran larvae, so butterfly and moth caterpillars. I'm a little bit more familiar with the literature for grassland birds and what they're eating, which definitely our moth and butterfly larvae are still critical components of many of those bird species' diet, both for their nestlings, and adults rely on a lot of those caterpillars as well. But we also start to get into more diverse groups of insects that are food for these birds, specifically. Grasshoppers are critically important for many of our grassland bird species, which we know are declining pretty rapidly. Other things like ants and crickets, beetles are another important group for many of our grassland birds. And they can make up really large components of the diet, even for adults. I don't know if you know about loggerhead shrikes. They're often also referred to as butcher birds. And these are the birds that you'll often see, blog posts or people's photos where they've impaled a small mammal or a small bird or mouse on a fence spike. And then they sort of eat from there, and that's where they get their moniker butcher bird. But actually 70% of their diet comes from invertebrates. So those small mammals are, a really great prey resource, but they're mostly eating ants, crickets, and grasshoppers throughout the day.
Wow.
I also was looking at some really interesting research about burrowing owls this morning. So burrowing owls are very small owls that nest underground, often in pre-made holes from prairie dogs or tortoise gophers in other areas. and they often have pretty messy nest entrances. And in fact, have I think like 80% of the time they bring manure, they bring livestock dung to the front of their nest. And one theory about why they do this is to attract dung beetles, which they then eat because invertebrates are an important component of burrowing owl diets. So just mind-blowing connections between animals.
Today on Strange Prairie Science.
It's a little muddled because they'll bring other trash too. Like they'll, if they find trash out on the prairie, they'll bring it, or they'll bring just plant litter and things. So yeah, the theory is not completely solid, but I don't know why else you would want manure at the entrance of your burrow besides bringing in prey, or maybe just camouflaging smell
Wow.
for your own predators.
Wow, that's some commitment to get a meal.
Definitely.
Okay, well that's I wasn't completely aware. I assumed that adult birds also did feast on insects here and there. So it's good to know for sure that they play an important part of a bird's diet, whether they're young or they're mature in age. Another thing I wanted to talk about today is we hear a lot about native plants as keystone species. And so I was thinking we could kind of go over what a keystone species is in regards to plants primarily. But then the second part of that could be, should we reinvent the way we think about insects and think of them as a vital keystone in their own right?
I think so. Just to talk about how you would define a keystone species or think about a keystone species, it's something, an organism that sort of helps hold the system all together, just like the keystone of an arch, which listeners can't see me making this, figure with my hands. But of course, the keystone of an arch is the one right at the top. And if you pull that apart, the arch falls down. So that's where the name comes from. So it's an organism that's really important, that has a disproportionately large impact on the ecosystem. And the idea of plants as keystone species is you might have a plant that supports a wide number of species of Lepidoptera, for example, butterflies and moths, larvae that eat that as a host plant. And then in turn, those butterfly and moth larvae can support. They can be food for all sorts of different critters. So that's the idea of plants as keystone species. So the idea that insects are keystone grew is absolutely also the case in like aquatic systems. You've got sea otters that can be keystone species because they feed on sea urchins. And if you remove sea otters, then sea urchins eat down plants. And the idea is just basically if you remove different parts of the system, it can fall apart quite quickly. And that's for sure true of different groups of pollinators. As we've been talking, like for example, for fringed orchids, if you take out those hawk moths, then you no longer have the fringed orchid. And for pollinators, you've got this diverse community, and we've often thought that diversity will help create some robustness to loss of biodiversity. So we know that a number of different pollinators are in decline, and we've assumed that our systems can be robust enough to lose some species without it all falling apart. But there's also evidence to suggest that you just remove one pollinator from the system. Like, for example, you take out a bumblebee species, and that can actually have big implications for the seed set of certain plants, and it might change how different pollinators interact with each other and the remaining community. And that can also eventually lead to ecosystem functioning. So, again, that full diversity of community, that's a really important thing. And it might not just come down to removing one species. Even if it's not considered a keystone species, removing it can have unexpected, unintended effects that can affect the whole community. So pollinators are definitely like a keystone group, but it definitely doesn't, that isn't to say that each species isn't important. I think, when we do talk about keystone groups, it sort of makes it sound like some plants are way more important than others. And in some ways they are, and in some ways they aren't, because as you know, like we can't just rely on oaks alone. That's not going to keep the system functioning. You also need flowering shrubs, and you also need wildflowers, and you need grasses.
Yeah.
So again, we have to really think more broadly about a full community of diversity of species.
It seems like the theme of today, too, that there's just all these wide-ranging things that are all kind of like the harmony of everything working together, all the fine pieces of the puzzle coming together in a myriad of ways. That just seems to be the overhauling theme of talking about insects and pollination benefit and ecosystem benefit, that everything is just kind of harmoniously playing a role together, and that's how things function, or function well, I guess. We just talked again about the hawk moth and the fringed orchid. I know some people are very aware of the relationship that monarchs have with milkweed. That's one that's talked about super often. But if we're gonna, maybe we can highlight some other Nebraska native plants and some relationships with specific pollinators if you had any in mind to talk about.
Sure, maybe we can take turns, right?
Yep.
So there are, I don't know, you can pick any Nebraska plant and we can talk about cool relationships, I think. And maybe that's a really good take-home message, is that you can plant a lot of native plants and have an impact no matter what you choose. You can plant really large deciduous trees, but you can also plant flowering shrubs. And this is almost one of my favorite times of year when stuff starts to bloom out, because there's just a lot of really interesting bees, for example, that visit plants in springtime in Nebraska. So really quickly, some interesting plant pollinator relationships. Well, there are quite a lot of bees that have a specific pollen needs, so they can only rear their young on the pollen of specific plants. And it might be one species, but more often it's a group of closely related species of plants. So they'll only collect pollen from Zizia, for example, golden alexanders, which aren't quite blooming yet, but will be soon, or Claytonia virginica. Sorry, what's the common name of that?
Spring
Spring
Beauty. Is that
Beauty.
spring?
Thank you. Yeah, that's Spring Beauty. Thank you so much. Yeah. So both of those plants and many others host these bees that have really specific pollen needs, and their life cycle is, completely tied to that plant. So
Wow.
the abundance of that plant determines how many young that bee can produce and where it can survive and how big the population can grow. So those there are spring blooming plants that host specialist bees. There are summer blooming plants, like there are a couple of specialist bees you can find on coneflowers or black-eyed Susans, but the really huge diversity of specialist bees comes in the fall when you start to have asters in bloom. There's a really big suite of aster specialists. So you can go out and check out sunflowers and the relatives and find longhorn bees in particular on those. And longhorn bees are named because they have especially long antenna. But they're really quite large and robust and really fuzzy and just dedicated to visiting sunflower plants. So those pollen specialists have really unique relationships and are really important for those bees. So, having those native plants is really critical for those species. They couldn't survive without them. And so plants like daylilies or hostas, while they can provide a little bit of resources to some pollinators, they are not supporting these species that have more specific needs.
Yeah, it seems like there's some opportunists out there that will forage on a lot of different stuff. And then there's our specialists that are the picky eaters that really require a certain kind of meal to get what they need. So,
Yes. That's right. That's totally right. And that's true for Lepidoptera as
yeah.
well. Have some species of butterflies that their caterpillars are happy to eat whatever plant they come across, or not really, but a large range of species, plants from completely different families. And then you've got plants that hone in on a specific genus of plants or even a specific species, like pipevine swallowtail really need their specific host plant. I find.
I know we talked about how pollinators support rare, endangered plants, but I thought it would also be interesting to talk about something that's very, very basic that we really haven't hit on. Pollination is done by adult insects. So if these insects don't reach adulthood, then pollination can't occur. I thought that was something so very basic that we forget about, like the importance of providing these natural native habitats so that we can rear these insects to adulthood. Otherwise, we won't have the insects to, help pollinate our squash or to help pollinate our, watermelon or whatever we have growing in our vegetable garden. And we won't have insects to pollinate our native wildflowers, like we talked about, whether in our suburban homes or in the rangelands that you mentioned were very important. I guess what's something that people can take away from this conversation? What's something vital that they can do to help pollinators, to help these insects reach adulthood and to contribute to this ecosystem harmony?
Yeah, I think I've got kind of two big ones that I like people to take away from really any presentation or talk that I give. And the first one is fairly simple and easy, and you'll definitely be on board. And that's plant native plants. Use things that are native to your region and your locality, because there are these really unique and special relationships that these plants have. And once you get started, and if you're observant, I feel like they'll take over. They at least have in my own yard, my own space, because I like to see those interactions, and I find it really special. I think one of the roadblocks that we have with a lot of people in native plants is the sort of status quo of our yard spaces and our public spaces. And I think we really need to let go of the tidiness of landscapes. When I look down my block, it's very clean. There's not a lot of leaf litter on the ground. There's not really much for standing stems in people's yards. It's a very cured and manicured bluegrass lawn that gets cut regularly. And while that supports a really limited number of invertebrates, it doesn't leave space for much else in our landscapes. So accepting and embracing sort of the untidy places, both in your own yard and in public spaces, is really important. Even places that are ignored, like weedy lots, are better at supplying for our pollinators than a bluegrass yard that gets mowed. Because those things, like our bees, our moths and our butterflies, they're overwintering either in undisturbed ground, or standing biomass, so those plant stems, or they're in that plant litter, as well as a lot of our ground-dwelling invertebrates need that sort of litter layer. So I haven't cut anything yet from my yard this year. I've got standing Indian grass. I've got lead plant remnants from last year, penstemon stems from last year, and I'll leave those until probably at least Mother's Day. I like to leave it until it gets pretty warm so those bees and other insects can emerge and be successful. And I think especially with leaf litter, I feel like I'm donating butterflies and moths to the neighborhood because I leave so much of my leaf litter where, often that's where they're pupating or overwintering. And I think it's really a source for our neighborhood of those species. So those are my two big ones that I like people to take away. I don't know if you have anything else to add, Jenny.
No, I think those are really good, right? Just to add that it can be really important to limit pesticides, especially to protect all those habitats. So, wherever possible, using control methods that don't, reaching for the insecticides shouldn't be the first thing that you do. It should be reducing the conditions that create pest outbreaks. It can be trying to manage them through other ways, non-chemical ways, and then only implementing insecticides when you reach this economic threshold. And, just as Ray mentioned, trying to tolerate a little bit more messiness can also mean recognizing that minor damage on your plant isn't a bad thing. It's a sign of life. You're supporting caterpillars, or you're supporting beetles. And that it also doesn't mean that that damage is going to kill your plant or hurt your plant. A lot of plants really tolerate herbivory. They're used to it. So not to worry about that kind of damage. And to just really use insecticides only when it's affecting the life of the plant, or when there's an economic threshold that reaches in which you need to take action. And then using insecticides in a way that can limit the impact on pollinators, to reduce the impact on pollinators and other beneficial insects too, because a lot of insecticides are broad spectrum, and that means that they can kill not just, the pest at hand, but a broad range of other species. And lasting impacts. So,
Should we mention herbicides at all? And I guess it's good that I have both of you here to maybe give a little insight on the effect of using herbicides on visiting insects. Because I know a lot of people might think, well, this is targeting plants, so this shouldn't be toxic to anything else other than the plant I'm targeting. But is that the case?
right. Some herbicides do have direct toxicity to pollinators. If you've got a long-lasting herbicide, for example, that stays active in the plant, that means something like a butterfly or moth caterpillar that's eating that plant is continuously exposed. Or sometimes a systemic herbicide can be taken up into pollen and nectar, and so pollinators that eat those resources can be exposed. And sometimes herbicides can be directly toxic, and even if it doesn't kill a pollinator outright, it can impact how they forage or impact how they reproduce. So the impacts of herbicides they can have direct impacts, but also the indirect impacts, just that the use of herbicides, the context really depends on the overall impact it'll have to pollinators. And of course, herbicides can be really important tools for managing habitat. There are some invasive plants that you cannot dig out by hand that don't respond to trimming or mowing or other land management activities. So herbicides can be really important in controlling those and limiting the impact, because invasive species have huge impacts on pollinators and wildlife too. So how you use herbicides can limit the impact to pollinators, though. And so, using them with care, keeping them on target, making sure that who's using them has plant ID training, applying them under the right conditions so that they don't drift off site, applying herbicides that aren't volatile or that are more targeted to specific weed groups or weed species, or applying them in a manner that really directs the impact directly to the plant. Those are all things that are really useful in, achieving the goal of weed management, but limiting the impacts to wildlife like pollinators.
Yeah, it makes sense to me to just that I guess that would be the thing that I would add, is just reminding people not to, when you see weeds, or our definitions of weeds are all different, because really a weed is just something you don't want in your garden, on a very basic level. So I think, the knee-jerk reaction to go grab these herbicides and to just, instead of any sort of attempt at mechanical removal, or thinking, actually this dandelion is probably not worth, dousing my whole yard. And dandelions are, the seeds are going to fly in, they're going to come back. It doesn't get very tall. It's a useful, non-native plant. It's just there's maybe responsible ways we can use herbicide if we're talking about eradicating like Canada thistle or Japanese honeysuckle or something. But in regards to what most people would identify as a garden weed, it's kind of dangerous to use herbicides in that kind of free way.
I think it's good to remember in yards too that that is also part of the system. And so herbicides can run off into water and into the street, and the water in the street goes into rivers and streams. And for some of us, that's our drinking water. And the water treatment plant process does not remove those chemicals. So It's just important to remember that what we do in our space does have wider impacts.
Well, it's been great talking to you both today. Xerxes is doing a lot of great things. You can participate in citizen science. You can see all their projects and resources on their website. Go to xerxes.org so that you can keep in touch and keep track of all the cool stuff going on and that they're doing.
Yeah, that's Xerces.
That's right.
Xerxes Blue Butterfly.
Because for a long time, I was writing down Xerxes, and it took me years to realize, nope, that's not quite right.
I learned why, I think Mace mentioned it, that it's the butterfly was named by a Frenchman. And so that's the French spelling of Xerxes, and that's why it's a C. Which, yeah, I didn't know. So
wow.
6 years into working for Xerxes.
Mystery solved. Thank you. Yeah. But it was great. This was really educational for me. I actually learned a lot of stuff. The world of botany and wildlife, there's just always so much to learn. There's an infinite amount of stuff to learn. So
this
was really cool. Well, this was fun. Thank you both again. I had a great time.
Thanks for the opportunity. Stephanie.
Yeah.
Appreciate
Glad
it.
You're doing it.
Take care. Thank you for tuning in to the Plant Native Nebraska podcast. If you need notes on anything mentioned in today's episode, check our website, plant-native-nebraska.captivate.fm, for more info. I want you to know you've made this podcast special just by listening in. But if you found real value in today's talk, you can both financially support future episodes and dive deeper into the topics we share by finding us on Patreon at patreon.com/plantnativenebraska. Thanks for listening.